Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads, featuring illuminated manuscripts, metalwork, carvings, and works by contemporary Ethiopian artists. On view now. For tickets and more information, you can visit PEM.org.
And the Office of the Massachusetts State Treasurer. The Unclaimed Property Division is holding unclaimed funds from medical bills, uncashed paychecks, savings accounts, and more. To see if you have unclaimed money, you can visit findmassmoney.gov.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We may always have Paris, but not L'Espalier. Now that the famed restaurant is closed after serving New England French cuisine for over 40 years, Boston's Je ne sais quoi index has taken a major plunge. Joining us to talk about this, to recap other local haunts that have said goodbye in 2018, and other headlines at the intersection of food culture and food policy is Corby Kummer. Corby, of course, is a senior editor at The Atlantic, a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and most importantly, a BPR contributor. Hey, Corby.
That is the most important thing.
To us it is. I'm glad it is to you.
Well, you know, L'Espalier has been known forever. I think 40 years, Deborah first said in her Globe piece, you know, a very fancy place, special occasion place, impeccable service, et cetera. But it's just one of so many restaurants that are closing. It almost seems like, dare I say, a trend?
Well, the trend, I think, is local ownership and leases going and rise of nationals. But let's go into some of them. So L'Espalier is kind of a victim of its own success, but it's mostly passing style. So it's white tablecloth. It's really fancy. What you go there for is the service and the cheese course, as Deborah pointed out. And that's why I tell people to go if you want a special occasion, you want to be treated beautifully, and you wanted this fabulous cheese cart. That's why you went to L'Espalier. It wasn't particularly the food. The food was just fine. But it had given rise to so much talent, Monsef Medeb. And now there's Alex Crabb and Shish Parsegian, his wife, who run... he was the chef at L'Espalier, and right down the street on Mass Ave, they have the absolutely terrific Asta restaurant. It's much barer bones. It's got its own style, I think terrific style, but it is, you know, very simple, and it's much more in tune with the way people want to eat today. And I think that's so much a part of what these closings are. I was very sad about Les Sablons in Harvard Square, which tried a new take on a very formal way of dining, elegant. It was Garrett Harker, whose hospitality lives on and reigns supreme at Eastern Standard, Island Creek Oyster Bar, and Branch Line. Those are all going strong. And Row 34, those are fantastic restaurants. But Les Sablons tried to take that kind of elegance, and the sort of narrow weirdness of the room in Harvard Square did it in. So I think it's style.
Is that what did it in?
No, what did it in is you couldn't find the entrance. I loved Les Sablons too. Tell me if you didn't know where the entrance was, you could get into the damn restaurant.
No, but
Corby,
you're right about the narrow. It was a very narrow
I know it was
room.
Narrow, but it was attractive narrow. You couldn't get in the door.
Well,
did you know where the door...
You just thought it's right across the street from the Charles Hotel.
Exactly.
But even
yeah.
then it was hard.
Can I tell you something, though? I think you're not being fair. I think you, Corby, are trying to... I think you're suggesting that it's sort of like the high-end whatever. I mean, on the other end of the spectrum, a place I loved that closed is Townsman, which was as sort of a down-to-earth kind of thing, right off the whatever that part of the highway is called.
It's the Greenway. It's the Chinatown part of the Greenway.
I mean, they are gone, and there's a whole bunch of... There's a restaurant. Marjorie and I have to admit our embarrassment.
I've never heard of it.
There's this survey done in the I think, the Improper Bostonian. A lot of people asked...
Eater.
I'm sorry. Asking a lot of people in your business which restaurants are most upset about closing in 2018 in Boston. And the only one that was mentioned by virtually everyone, not only had neither Marjorie nor I ever been to, neither Marjorie nor I had ever heard of.
I know.
We had to look up how to pronounce it. Erbaluche? Is that how you say it?
Erbaluche. This is what has caused the most tears to be shed.
What was it?
A very quirky restaurant right in the middle of Park Square. So it was behind what I think we'll always think of as the Statler Hilton, but is the Park Plaza. It was extremely odd and distinctive and a complete labor of love from Charles Draghi, who had spent time in northern Italy, and his partner, who had their own garden in Watertown or Arlington, I think, and would bring in. So it was this very individual take on northern Italian cuisine. It was original. It was full of herbs. It was stuff from their rooftop, from their own garden. And it had a killer bolognese sauce. So these were great things. And what amazed me, and I don't mean to, you know, sorry if this comes out wrong, is that it lasted as long as it did. It was so individual. When somebody told me how she was at a hotel and business in Park Square and wound up at this place nobody knew about called Erbaluce, I was just open-mouthed because I couldn't believe it survived as long as it did. Real estate is so unforgiving. It was great, and I want to see Charles Draghi come back and cook someplace else. But it was a big challenge to do that right in the middle of downtown.
You know what's interesting to me, at least? We're going to talk very briefly in a few minutes to our listeners about the restaurant that may have disappeared in the last year that meant the most to them and is the most upsetting to them. When a restaurant closes that I like, it's like a really intimate experience. I mean, it's just because, I guess because they're also huge in our lives, but much more than a store, at least to me, than a store you used to go to or a donut shop, even though I love a good donut shop. I mean, there's like an emotional connection a lot of people have to these places they frequent. Is there not?
Sure, and I felt that very much about, I felt it about Striptease, because what an unusual, fabulous place that was a cross between a diner and a completely cutting-edge Asian-American restaurant.
Yes. Yeah.
Unbelievably original, unbelievably enjoyable, with absolutely terrific service in Watertown. And Tim Maslow, thank goodness, is cooking in Harvard Square, and what is the name? It's like Oklahoma State Line or something. I should remember that. But we have that local talent. Tim Maslow still here. So I tend to have really personal relationships with locally owned places. Like when I read the Crema Cafe in
Harvard Square,
which was the best coffee in Harvard Square and so original, did its own baking, really good baking, right in the middle of Harvard Square. I would meet people there. I hate that it's closing. Someplace like Brasserie Joe on Huntington Ave across from the back entrance of the Prudential. That was a wonderful place to meet people, but it didn't have that local stamp that will really make me miss stuff.
You know, may I ask you something, Corby? They mentioned in one of these stories about Erbaluce, the place in Bay Village that closed, that the building was bought by a developer and wanted a restaurant there, but they needed to do some reconstruction, and that would require Erbaluce to give up its city-owned liquor license, which they couldn't afford to do. Are liquor licenses unnecessary? Because you heard this a lot. Anna Pressley, this is one of her causes the city council, that in many restaurants in Roxbury, Mattapan, couldn't get liquor license, Dudley, et cetera, couldn't get liquor license because they were so expensive. Are we out of whack on the price of our liquor licenses, or is this just this the way it goes everywhere?
Oh, completely out of whack. It's like the taxi medallions that now have lost all their value because of Uber. These liquor licenses are jealously guarded because they're limited by the city, and the city makes money on them, and the whole city council, I think, has to vote on expanding the number of liquor licenses. So the process is unnecessarily cumbersome. Yes, I think it's ridiculous we're out of whack and that restaurants should have a much fairer crack at getting liquor licenses.
We're talking to Corby Cummings. Can I add one restaurant to the list since I want to be part of the conversation too? Did you ever go to Tupelo? It's a few blocks from where I live in Union Square.
I did really like Tupelo because, again, it was quirky, original, fresh, and, you know, odd and also low priced.
Well, and it's also on. I just want to do a shout out because I met her many years ago when she worked at Whole Foods. Her name is Renee McLeod, and she had a kid in school with my kids. It was a fabulous place. Obviously, it's too late for that. But she also runs Pizzi Pies.
That's great.
With your buddies from Community Servings on today. Community Servings, Pizzi Pies, and Joanne Chang, I would argue, make the three best pies in Greater Boston. And this is a wonderful woman, and it's an opportunity to.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you because I love her. And I love the fact that she's got this pie shop and she's so dedicated and she's overflowing with personality. She's so the minute fabulous. You meet her, you just become her fan for life.
We're talking to our food guy, Corby Kummer. So, Corby, I was always kind of one that made fun of this food styling stuff, even though I know you have to make it look beautiful for the magazines and stuff. But what they're talking about in the story in the Globe by Cindy Keene is that it's a lot about Instagram and so-called food porn for all your friends.
I love that expression, food porn.
I guess this woman's pretty talented. They feature. She talks about how she made carrots in the shape of lobsters. That's pretty impressive, isn't it?
Well, for a long time, this has been one of those open, fascinating secrets about the food biz. And what was sort of unacknowledged particularly, except in the headline of this piece in the business section of the Globe, was that this very talented woman, Monica Mariano, is working in the old strictures of the profession. What do I mean by that? She gets big advertising accounts to make stuff look gorgeous for big companies. And she herself is a very interesting, sympathetic person who grew up running the cold cut slicing machine at her parents' deli in Waltham. They were Italian immigrants. So that's all terrific. And she does dancing cookies and stop motion videos of soup being swirled. But really, the phenomenon that is pointed to in the story is making food look good for Instagram, because everybody is now a food stylist and a photographer. And most of my friends who are on Instagram, admittedly, they're foodies, but the vast majority of the accounts they look at are people taking pictures of their food. So everybody's a food stylist now. And I think that what we should be having is, how-to guides to make your pictures look better. I hate it as a phenomenon because you don't bother to eat at restaurants. Everybody has to stop dead to take some beautiful picture. And there was a piece in the New York Times last year about restaurants that have changed their lighting to make their food look better on Instagram because they know that's a driver of business for their own restaurants.
I can't believe Marjorie mentioned this woman carving a carrot in the shape of a lobster and failed to mention what I showed you yesterday. Is over the weekend, I carved a carrot in the shape of myself. And the likeness, did everybody say the likeness
was
unbelievable?
Frightened by this, Jim.
No, it was amazing.
So,
it
Corby. Amazing.
But, Jim, can you spell out corporate logos and pomegranate seeds? She can do that, Monica Mariano.
Without having them go dull in the light.
Exactly. If I chose to, I could. Okay. Now, Corby, we need, I hate to bring up personal stuff on the air because it's inappropriate, but I'm not going to be able to talk to you later. So Marjorie is thinking at some point in the spring going to Europe, and she's very upset that she won't be able to get bovine growth hormone anywhere there, which she has really thrived on here. Is there anything you can do to help her out?
You know, I can see if I can pull some strings in illicit, unregulated European Union countries.
You know, the reason I bring this up, Marjorie and I are reading
a story
about these chemicals and additives that are perfectly permissible in the United States in our milk, our Mountain Dew, again, causing cancer, that are correctly banned in the European Union. So, and this is not just in the era of Trump. Am I right about this or am I wrong?
So you're right, but you're wrong in thinking it's a particularly responsible or well-written story.
Okay.
This was in the New York Times. It was in the Ask Well column, and it was just the simple, what is the EU ban that the U.S. doesn't?
Right.
And indeed, these yellow dyes that can cause hyperactivity and allergy in children, like itching. I was a little worried about Mountain Dew now making me itch my skin and memory loss and nerve problems. And all of these possible carcinogens, the whiteners in flour that make baked goods look better and white. Yes, it sounds alarming, but what I didn't get from this story is the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, ignoring compelling evidence that the European Union has found? Or is it something like when the European Union for a while banned GMOs because of a glyphosate story, the herbicide that is licensed by Monsanto, a completely discredited French study saying glyphosate could be a carcinogen? It's still a live question, but that study itself was discredited. So I don't know how dangerous, especially because so much is dose dependent. I'm not speaking in favor of chemicals. I'm not saying that the FDA is flawless, But I am saying, so far, we have not seen evidence of the FDA's like the EPA, which is really
abandoning
its responsibility.
Can we agree that bovine growth hormone is probably not a good thing?
Oh, bovine growth hormone is bad for cattles.
But it's in there. It's permitted in their feed, and then we drink it in our milk, don't we?
That's true. And I don't think that ractamine, which makes pigs grow faster and is banned in Europe and causes hyperactivity, these are really gross chemicals. But the problem with this piece was it mentioned ractamine and bovine growth hormone, which could be genuinely alarming, with a lot of other additives like these flour whiteners that might not be alarming and might not be used in quantities that could cause problems.
Okay, that takes care of that story then.
Well, for him it does, doesn't it?
I want to move on to one of the most disgusting things I've read in a long time, and I can't believe that the federal government would do this, but apparently they are. They're talking about these poor people who live in this county in Iowa, have lived there for years, and because of new rules from Congress and the Trump administration, they are basically trapped in their own house because this is a terrible stink from the farms outside. They have health problems. Her husband's got something called chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Other people are talking about bronchitis. Neighbors, because of restrictions that they've let up about emissions in the air. I know you want everybody to make money, but this is horrible.
Let's rip into the Trump administration over this. This is something that is unambiguous and completely wrong. To protect big, powerful, campaign-donating livestock producers, especially poultry and pigs, the EPA is saying, you know, you don't have to report what you're emitting into the air, even if it's dangerous amounts of ammonia that cause people like your workers to die. You know, we don't want to bother you with that paperwork. And besides, nobody's likely to do anything about it anyway. So it's a horrifying rule. Yes, Marjorie, what you say about being trapped in your own house because you can't stand the stink, you have to keep your windows closed, you can't go out on your porch, your lawn's turned brown.
Yeah.
These are horrifying problems that Ted Genoway's in The Chain wrote about, that there was a terrific piece by, I think, Boyce Upholt in the last year about effective redlining of African-American farmers who can only afford land for their farms near big pig farms and big manure. So it's this horrible institutionalized racism that continues right now in Iowa and North Carolina and big farming country. But right now, the story that we're talking about is this complete withdrawal of responsibility by the EPA, no longer requiring big companies to report their emissions. And it applies to the big companies only because they're the ones who do it in quantity that are really dangerous.
This the new Congress could take. This is just horrible.
No, but to override a regulation promulgated by whoever did it that needs Senate approval and signing by the President of the United States. By the way, the only good news out of the EPA before we bid you adieu there, Corby, is that Scott Pruitt can't find a job. I don't know if you read that in the Washington Post or the New York Times, but that he's meeting like in McDonald's or something in Washington.
Didn't he steal enough money to keep himself
Maybe
set
he did.
For Here's
life.
What they could do. They could haul in these poor people and have them in hearings in Congress. They get a lot of coverage in the House about how they're being killed.
Why don't they make them breathe this crap themselves? How about that? Is an alternative?
Why doesn't Congress give up their salaries while the government
or live in a coal
thank
mine?
Thank you very much. Yeah. Hey, Corby, it's great to talk to you as always. Thanks so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Corby Kummer. Our food writer Corby Kummer joins us every week. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and a Boston Public Radio contributor. Corey, thanks again. Up next, Morning Edition's Joe Matthew joins us from NPR's headquarters in D.C., where he's been covering the swearing-in of the new Congress. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.